All right. Hey, everybody, and welcome. This is a surprise. I guess we'll call it a pop-up Yvonne Brooks show. I haven't done a show in quite a while and feeling a little guilty about that. And here I am in, let's see, sounds good. Here I am in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. I've been traveling for the last couple of weeks. I was traveling in the US, and then I traveled here to Brazil, and I've been in Brazil for almost a week now. And I've got like 45 minutes to spare, and I figured, what the hell, let's do a quick show. So surprise, surprise, here we are live on YouTube and on Facebook. Let me just make sure we're on Facebook. Yeah, we're live on Facebook. Hey, look at that. And we even have some people who are watching this. You guys spend way too much time on Facebook and YouTube, because that's the only way you would know the show is on right now. So I thought I'd give you a quick update on what's happening in Brazil, and then a couple of topics I want to talk about. We'll see how much of them. There's a bunch of stuff in the news, but I have to tell you, I'm sitting here on my. I mean, I love Rio de Janeiro. Rio de Janeiro has to be the most beautiful city in the world, just in terms of its geography. I think I've said that before, and I'm sitting here. And right outside my window are the cliffs, the Atlantic Ocean, the mountain in front of me. I can see, the mountain with the Jesus sculpture right on top of it. I can see that right in front of me. There's a cloud covering most of Jesus up. And there's a favela, one of these slums right here on the slope of the mountain that's right to the left of my hotel room. And I can see it right here, and there's a road winding down on the cliff here. Anyway, gorgeous, 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 beautiful. It really it really is an amazing place. So I've been in Brazil, just got to Rio a couple of hours ago, but I've been in Brazil since late last week. And I've gave a talk yesterday in São Paulo. At a very large forum. I've been here before and spoken at forums at these conferences in Porto Alegre, and I've spoken for some student groups in Brazil before. This is the first time I've spoken for this organization called IFL. It's the Institute for Freedom, Liberty, something like that. So anyway, it's a great organization, and they have chapters in a number of cities around the country. And one of the things that is common to them and to the organization IEE that runs the forum in Porto Alegre is that these are groups of businessmen, typically young, under 35, entrepreneurs and businessmen who get together on a weekly basis and discuss ideas. And so it's kind of a, and they have, and not everybody can just come. And if you come, you have to be engaged, and you have to read, and you have to, and one of the required readings for these chapters, both in São Paulo and Porto Alegre, and I think in some of the others, is Atlas Shrugged. Atlas Shrugged is one of the required readings for this group of businessmen in Brazil. And then once a year, these chapters put on a big day long, and in Porto Alegre, it's almost a day and a half. Big kind of conference event, and in Porto Alegre, it's massive. I think last time was there was in April, and they had 6,000 people there. And this one that I did yesterday in São Paulo, we had almost 1,000 people, so somewhere over 900 people were in the audience. And yesterday was more like a half day event. And they're typically terrific. The panels, they have keynote speakers. Yesterday's keynote speaker was Peter Thiel, who flew in from the United States just to do this. And I'm usually on a panel. They give you a few minutes to talk, to kind of set up the theme and the topic, and then from there. They ask you questions, and yesterday the questions were excellent. It went right to the core of what we're all about the morality of capitalism. As I encourage you all to watch this, I'll put it up on my YouTube channel, The video, it was live streamed yesterday, so I just have to find it and kind of edit out my segments and then put them up. But I think you'll really enjoy it. I gotta really talk about the morality of capitalism. Tonight, I'm actually giving a talk to a small group of this, again, associated with this business group at a restaurant here in Rio de Janeiro, in Leblon, for those of you who know Rio. And then on Monday, I go to another one of these forums, another one of these big conferences. They're also expecting about 1,000 people in Belo Horizonte, which is another city here, a major city in Brazil. I've never been there. It should be fun. And then the day after that, on Tuesday, I'm giving a talk to a smaller group, probably about 140 people, in Vitória, which is on the coast north of Rio de Janeiro. Also a city I've never been to, and I'm looking forward to being there. So great trip. My wife and I also went to Salvador just to vacation, just to see it. We'd never been there. Really interesting place, really fascinating. So, and look, I love Brazil. The people are friendly, they're passionate. It seems like at these forums, all Brazilians tend to be decent public speakers. They just have that way of speaking passionately and you know, with contact with the audience. Very few of them, I find, kind of the traditional boring, reading their notes kind of speakers. And actually, yesterday, they had this one entrepreneur. He runs actually the largest fast food chain, he claims, in the world here in Brazil. And man, was he passionate and yelling and screaming. It was quite entertaining to watch him. So I think in all of these talks, the key message is going to be the importance of morality to the defense of capitalism, the importance of philosophy to grounding capitalism and defending it and properly understanding what it is and how it works. And like the rest of the world, Brazil certainly needs this. One of the things, again, I find interesting here is the number of people here in Brazil who've read Atlas Shrugged. I think I posted on Facebook a picture of at the airport in São Paulo, in the big international airport, in the bookstore. There was Atlas Shrugged right there in the airport bookstore. So Atlas Shrugged is quite a popular book, it seems, in Brazil. A lot of people have read it. And they seem to say, you know, there's a certain seriousness, there's a certain intellectuality I find to Brazilian culture. And that is really, I find, is very impressive. And I'm seeing real energy among kind of the free market groups within Brazil. It's every time I come every few years, it's bigger, it's more energized, it's growing. There's a new political party that you could call kind of libertarian, which has a very good political candidate. We'll see how much votes he gets, but you know, I think in the last public in the last poll they did, he was like a 3% from zero. And this is the first time they've really had a true free marketer running for president. And I think we're gonna see more energy behind his candidacy. And then I think in the future we're gonna see more and more and more energy. There's also a new translation of The Fountainhead in the works. That's going to be published here in Brazil next year with a major publisher. It's going to put a lot of marketing effort into it. There's a new translation, or a first-time translation, of Return of the Primitive, the book of essays on kind of the pre-environmentalist movement that Ayn Rand wrote, that Peter Schwartz edited and wrote a couple of chapters in. That's going to be coming out here in Brazil next year. I've also been in discussion with another publisher here in Brazil to publish all of Ayn Rand's nonfiction, all the other nonfiction that are not yet translated. And I think that the priority there is going to be The Virtue of Selfishness, which already has been published here but needs a new publication. Capitalism, Not Known Ideal, and we'll see what else. Maybe even The Romantic Manifesto. And then possibly either Equal is Unfair or Free Market Revolution as well in Portuguese. So a lot of exciting things happening in Brazil in terms of Ayn Rand and the potential and translations and books coming out and just a lot of energy here. So it really is. It's fun to see. And, if I can say so, I become among these groups and among the students here in Brazil, I become kind of a mini celebrity. And people know who I am, and people respond very positively to my talks. A number of people yesterday said, "Oh, wow, that was so good. What do we need to read?" And I recommended my talk, Atlas Shrugged, and I think other people have already told them they need to go and read Atlas Shrugged. So I think if anything, my presence here and the more we are here as objectivists, the more likely it is that these ideas are going to spread. You need to show up. You need to be in these places to have an impact. And I know a lot of you are skeptical about the possibility of having an impact outside of the United States. But I'll tell you, there's more excitement, there's more passion, there's more interest in free market ideas, I feel, in places like Brazil, and I'd say Brazil in particular, but in places like Brazil than there is in the United States right now. And we'll see if it continues, but it's growing, it's intensifying, and I've seen the growth over the last 6 years. The other thing I'll tell you is, certainly this is true in Europe, but even in Brazil and Argentina, it's just a more intellectual culture. There's just more interest in ideas, qua ideas. And I'll get to this theme in a minute, qua the United States. I want to talk a little bit about culture of the United States, in particular about the Tea Party. I'd like to say, we're going to talk a little bit about the Tea Party and what I think happened in terms of the Tea Party. But it's I find it fascinating, and I find there a lot of excitement here and a lot of interest. So yeah, somebody's asking, Atlas Shrugged, should I give it a read? Absolutely. I mean, every civilized person in the world should read Atlas Shrugged. So it's the most important book written in the 20th century, maybe the most important book written in the last 2,000 years. And I think it'll end up being the most influential book written in the 20th century in terms of the future of mankind. So the future of civilization, it will have profound impact. So anybody who hasn't read Atlas Shrugged, go read it. Wow. And I'm jealous. I'm jealous of anybody who is reading Atlas Shrugged for the first time. How much fun is that? Anyway, so here I am in my hotel room in Rio de Janeiro. Those of you who subscribe to my channel, watch my videos, get a tour of hotel rooms around the world. This one, as I said, has a magnificent view of Rio de Janeiro, of the mountains, of the ocean, of the rocks, of just I think the most beautiful city in the world. Also one of the more violent ones, so I'm going to be ultra careful as I travel around the city. All right, so a few things I want to talk about. I want to talk about the Tea Party, what I think happened to the Tea Party. I want to talk very briefly about, I'll talk about this in a future show, about the new trade agreement with Mexico. And I want to talk about, oh my God, there was one other topic I wanted to talk about. There's so much stuff in the news that I haven't got to. Oh, yeah, Trump's comments there about Google. Let me just say quickly about the trade agreement with Mexico, because I know those of you who love Trump or love tariffs, so think Trump has a strategy and is smart or whatever. This is proof that he's succeeding. Look, NAFTA was no good, now it's better, and all because of Trump's threats of tariff. I mean, look, when he started this tariff thing, I said, and you can go back and check, that the outcome is going to be, because nobody wants to get into a trade war with the United States. It's stupid. People know it's stupid. I don't think Donald Trump knows it's stupid, but I don't think people in China and in Mexico are as dumb about economics as Donald Trump and his advisors are. So they have no interest in raising tariffs on themselves. Mexico does not want to leave NAFTA because does not want to destroy NAFTA because it realizes what a huge boon it is to them. It's just, we're too stupid to know how big of a boon it is to us. I said at the time that what would happen is that these foreign countries would give us something. They will give us something they were probably going to do anyway. And Donald Trump will declare victory in the name of free trade, because the markets will open up a little bit of fraction. And that's exactly what's happened here in Mexico. Actually, it's worse in Mexico. So we haven't got free trade with Mexico. This new deal with Mexico is not a free trade deal. It's not, doesn't bring us closer to free trade. Donald Trump is not against tariffs. That is a complete mythology. He sometimes says he's for let's get rid of all tariffs, but he's about as serious about that as he is about almost anything else he says. He's not serious about anything he says. But he's not serious about zero tariffs. I mean, that's absurd. The Europeans have given us nothing in terms of moving us towards zero tariffs. Mexico has done nothing to move us towards zero tariffs. If you're serious about zero tariffs, then the way to do it is to zero out your own tariffs. Raising tariffs in order to get to zero tariffs is like one of the dumbest strategies in human history. All that's happened with Mexico is we've altered the deal so that it's more difficult for some products to get into the United States under NAFTA. So what was happening was that a lot of companies were importing things, were exporting stuff into Mexico and then moving it into the United States in order to benefit from lower tariffs. So that is gone, which will actually, in a sense, raise prices for American consumers and is worse for us. They've clarified certain, they've modernized it, what they call. So they brought it up to date. But NAFTA, the deal with Mexico, is 90% the same deal we had before. There's a little tinkering at the edges, but none of the tinkering at the edges has brought us towards greater free trade. It's made the deal a little bit better for everybody, for both Mexico and the United States. By the way, there's nothing in the deal that involves there's nothing in the deal that involves Mexico paying for the wall. I don't know why, but that somehow didn't make it into the deal. Again, as I said, tariffs. Trump is not really serious about anything, including Mexico will pay for the wall. It mandates $16 an hour wages on U.S. sourced steel. It's not. There's nothing free trade about this U.S. Mexico deal. It's another NAFTA with different restrictions. I'm not for NAFTA. I'm for the United States unilaterally lowering tariffs to zero. We don't need NAFTA. We don't need the World Trade Organization. We don't need any of these organizations. All we need is to lower tariffs. The advantage of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization is they often place pressure on other countries to lower tariffs as well. And indeed, before Trump, we actually had a regime around the world with the lowest tariffs in human history, lower than the 19th century, lower than any other point in the 20th century. And it's low. So, you know, just you don't have to believe me. Just go and read the New Deal. And the New Deal is not moving us towards greater free trade. It's just another NAFTA. I said I would get rid of NAFTA and lower tariffs to zero. That's not what's happened. It's not what he's done. It's not even close to what he's done. All it is now greater restrictions. Here we go. You're on. Trump is not perfect, but it's better than Elizabeth Warren. Who cares? Elizabeth Warren's not president. When Elizabeth Warren was running against Donald Trump, then you can bring up that argument. Right now, Donald Trump is president. And our job as believers in liberty and people who believe in freedom and who advocate for freedom and liberty is to criticize and to attack those things that he does that move us away from liberty and freedom. And I think that's most of what he does. So is he moving us away from liberty and freedom at the slower pace that Elizabeth Warren would? Maybe. But who cares? Elizabeth Warren is not president. Donald Trump is president. So, and I don't, again, I want to get away from this. Let's just take one at a time what Donald Trump is doing. This deal with Mexico is meaningless. It's no great improvement. And in some things, it makes things worse in terms of trade. So there is nothing here, right? Nothing here about making things freer for Americans. So Boaz asks the typical, you know, not a criticism of you, Boaz, but this is the question everybody asks. This is a completely collectivistic question. How can U.S. workers compete with Mexican workers? And my answer to that is very simple. Who cares? There is no such thing as a U.S. worker, a Mexican worker. What does that make a difference? Right? U.S. workers can't compete with Mexican workers, and they won't in the future be able to compete with African workers when Africa becomes industrialized. And they can't compete with many Chinese workers. So how can we compete with machines and farming? It's not fair to all those farmers that now we have machines and they can't compete with the machines. That's progress, people. And the fact that Mexico now has all these workers coming online and they work cheaper than American workers and they're less regulated than American workers and they don't have health benefits that American workers have. By the way, the solution to that is maybe lower regulations in the United States, maybe stop mandating employers have to do this and this and this and give all the benefits and all these wage increases to have. How about freedom? So instead of placing burden on Mexico, how about eliminating regulations and restrictions on the U.S. companies? That would be a pro-free market. That would be, see, the way to measure any political action is it decreasing coercion in the world or is it increasing coercion in the world? This Mexico deal, I don't think does, it's probably neutral because it increases coercion in some realms, decreases coercion in other realms. But that's the measure. The way if you want to make American workers more competitive, decrease coercion in America. Don't make it worse for Mexicans. Don't make it harder for Mexican companies to produce. Make it easier for American companies to produce. But at the end of the day, who cares, right? Whoever makes a better product at a better price should win out. It doesn't matter where that product is made. And American workers then have to figure out something that they're good at, that given their wages and given their education and given their abilities, they are good at. And until they find that, you've got a problem. So the problems in America have to do with our educational system. The problem have to do with us finding a competitive edge. But we have it, right? There's no unemployment. There's very little unemployment in the U.S. today. People who have an education have fantastic jobs in the United States. We do things that nobody else in the world can do. And that's what we should focus on. We should focus on those things that we have a comparative advantage. So you want to import things that are cheap. You want to get rid of farmers if you can replace them with machines. You want to get rid of workers if you can replace them with robots. By the way, 80 to 90% of all the so-called manufacturing jobs that were destroyed in the United States were replaced by robots, not replaced by Chinese or Mexican workers. That is a complete and utter myth. So, no, this is why I believe in immigration. I believe we should increase immigration. I think we should increase legal immigration. We should get as many people coming to the United States who could find a job as possible. They raise the standard of living. They raise the quality of life. They produce things. And if they can produce things cheaper, then there's more money for people to do other things with. Freedom is good. Tariffs are taxes. Tariffs are coercive. You don't achieve a good by embracing an evil. Tariffs are evil. You never embrace tariffs. Taxes are evil. You never advocate for raising taxes, ever, ever. There are no circumstances where I would advocate for raising taxes. You have a deficit, you cut spending. No, I mean, anyway. I'm gonna move on because I've talked about these tariffs ad nauseum, and again, I predicted exactly what happened with this deal with Mexico, and that is that it would be so trivial, it would be meaningless, that they would concede something, but it would be nothing, and it would certainly not be worth all the hassle and the propaganda and all the BS that we've had to tolerate from the Trump administration in order to get this very little. And unfortunately, as I've said, there's been very, very, very little wins or very little accomplishments for the Trump administration in terms of long-term success. Okay, we've got a super chat. That's always good. Would you make an episode rebuking distributionism? It's one of the more popular third position stance. I'm afraid that'll soon gain popularity. Yes, I'd be happy to. I need to kind of research what, in a sense, what distributionism as an ism is. But yeah, I'd be happy to. So in a future episode, I'll do an episode on that. But I do want to talk about one thing. And by the way, those of you interested in just a basic economic text, my favorite economics book, Introductory Economic Books, is Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. So I definitely recommend that. I think you'll learn so much if you can get through that book. It's not an, even though it's Economics in One Lesson, it's a very introductory book. It's not easy because it was written in 1947. And I think authors back then expected more of their readership than they do now. So it's not in the friendly, easy style of today's books. But it is the best introductory book I know on economics. So I encourage you all to read it. But if you want to understand some of these issues about tariffs and trade and why shooting yourself in the foot is never good, even if the other guy shoots themselves in the foot as well, you know, how all of these are examples of the broken window fallacy and how so much of our economic policy, including tax cuts, which are supposedly good, but are meaningless when you don't cut spending. All of that is really covered in Economics in One Lesson. So I encourage you. So I will research distributism and get back to you. All right. I wanted to talk about this one issue that has come up a few times. You know, so I did a show a while ago, I think about a week or two ago, and somebody asked me during the Q&A, it was a kind of an open live Q&A, they asked me, where do I think there's more possibilities to convert people to our ideas, the ideas of Ayn Rand, the ideas of objectivism, or more broadly, the ideas of free market? And, you know, it was a question out of nowhere, and I thought about it a little bit, and I said, at the end of the day, I think if we're talking about young people, I think first, young people over older people. And I think second, I actually think you've got a better chance of converting young people who tend to be on the left than you do of converting young people who tend to be on the right. And I'm not talking about the nutty left or the nutty right. I'm talking about left of center. I'm talking about people who like Sam Harris and people who like Steven Pinker and people who tend to be kind of the secular rational left. And I said, I think that it's more likely to get them than the kind of right of center who tend to be more religious, tend to be supportive of Trump in politics. Just so, you know, kind of the young Republicans, Turning Point USA versus the kind of more apolitical kind of left. Leftist. And I said the left. Now, I don't know how strongly I believe that. I think that's an empirical question that needs to be tested. I think that there are people on both the right and the left that can be attracted to objectivism and are attracted to objectivism. But when asked what I think was easier, I said those on the left. And I think that's true because I think the fundamental issue, if you're going to accept objectivism, is that you have to accept reason. You have to accept rationality. You have to accept the evidence of the senses and reality is real. And so center left is more likely than center right to be attracted to these ideas because they fundamentally accepted reason and rationality. They just don't know how to apply it. And they don't fully understand what it is. I mean, you can see that with Pinker and Harris. They then reject free will and so on. But I actually think the free will issue is a relatively easy issue as compared to the religious issue, which you have on the center right. So while, in my view, you go after all those groups and both those groups, again, I think the prevalency of people who become objectivists, they tend to come from that center left. Although, again, people come from all over the political map. So I posted this. I didn't post it, but the video went up, and people started, "Oh, Iran's completely detached. You don't know what you're talking about." The real and there was a lot of talk about the Tea Party. So I thought I'd say a few words about the Tea Party because people think, "Oh, that was the real chance we had. The Tea Party. That's That's where we could have had a real impact is with the T-bar. And that's absurd and ridiculous. And first, I think it's important to note that we tried. I don't know how many Tea Party events I spoke at. Dozens. All over the country. I spoke at the national ones. I spoke at the big one, the 400,000 person one in Washington, D.C., in the mall in Washington, D.C. in, what was it, 2009. There's video of me. And there's, I actually did a Glenn Beck show from the stairs of the Capitol that day talking. So we did a ton of talks in front of Tea Party groups. So we tried to engage them and we tried to have an impact on them. But what I discovered, for what it's worth, I guess, the conclusion I came to was that the Tea Party was ultimately hopeless. And what I think happened to the Tea Party is they went nowhere. And they went nowhere because they didn't really believe in anything. They didn't have an idea. They had a certain sense of life. They had an American sense of life. And if you went to a Tea Party gathering back then, the average age was between 55 and 75. It was depending on the group, the particular group. But it was always older people. Older people with a kind of frustrated sense of life, with a kind of perspective of nostalgia for the 50s, nostalgia for our past long gone, a love, a visceral love of the founding fathers, a huge amount of patriotism, a love for what America was, but real intellectual ignorance, real lack of ability to think through issues, and it really manifested itself in how inconsistent they were. So they believed in liberty, they believed in freedom, up to when it intervened in something they cared more about emotionally. Some of my favorite Tea Party stories have to do with things like, all this don't tread on me signs and shrink the government and balance the budget and all this stuff. And then next to it would be keep your hands off of my Medicare. And if you know anything about Medicare, there is no way to balance the budget. There's no way to shrink government if you keep your hands off of Medicare. And Medicare is just an entitlement. It's a redistribution. It's a massive redistribution scheme. But as soon as you criticize Medicare or Social Security or anything like that, these people got so angry. They got so furious. They got so excited. They were anti-intellectual. They had no consistency, no ideas. They were driven purely by emotion. Now, again, I'm generalizing. I know some of you were in the Tea Party. Some of you were very intellectual. Some of you made the best effort in the world to try to convince people that your ideas were the right ideas and that your ideas, could really have a huge impact on their lives. And there were a lot of heroic people who worked really, really hard to try to have a positive influence on the Tea Party. We all failed because its essential character was anti-intellectual. Its essential character was accepting of religion, embracing of religion, making religion a big part of the Tea Party. And I know some groups are more religious than other groups, but anytime I went after religion, most people didn't care, but there was a small group that got really, really upset. And, it's very, very frustrating to hear now about people, the Ayn Rand Institute didn't do enough in the Tea Party. We tried. We did a huge amount of work. But the fact is that the revolution we want to instigate, the revolution that America needs, the revolution that America has to have, the revolution, the only kind of revolution that's going to save this country, sense of life is not enough. Loving the founding fathers is not enough. One has to have a coherent political agenda. One has to have a moral conviction. One has to have ideas. One has to have ideologically true ideas, a true ideology. One has to stand for something, not for a bromide of the founding fathers, but for the true ideals of the Enlightenment. And for that, you have to understand what the ideals of the Enlightenment were. And when I would ask people what are the Founding Fathers about, they had no idea. I mean, the most intellectual thing they could say is, oh, something about the Judeo-Christian tradition. Really? But the idea that the founders stood for individualism and reason and rationality, that reason and individualism are the key characteristics of America, of the founding of America, what makes America unique, that they lead to the idea of freedom, that they are the necessary ideas to make freedom a reality. That, the Tea Party had no clue about that. And when you explain it to them, yeah, I would get constant standing ovations. They loved me. They loved me. Until you got to some tricky issue, or until you got at something challenging, or until you mentioned Medicare and having to phase Medicare out, or their grandchildren subsidizing their health care, and how is that right, and how evil was it of them, old people who should be relatively wealthy because they've had a lifetime worth of to save, how evil is it of them to expect their grandchildren to pay their medical bills, whether they deserve it or not, right? To force their grandchildren to do. The grandchildren who are poor, who haven't had a lifetime of being able to save money for their retirement, a lifetime of being able to save money in their health saving accounts or for their health care. No, their grandchildren who are starting out in life, who are still poor, they have to subsidize the grandparents. Ooh, and you told them that, they would get angry. So the Tea Party failed because it was an anti, not just non, but anti-intellectual. They didn't want to hear these ideas. So I got a lot of invitation at the beginning of the Tea Party to come and speak. I gave dozens of these talks at Tea Party groups all over the country, in Arizona, in Minnesota, in Michigan, in the Midwest, on the East Coast, all over the place, in South Carolina. I remember after my talk, these ladies came up to me and really tried to convert me to Christianity. I mean, they really made an effort. And, you know, within about 15 minutes of them trying, they were both pretty much in tears because I'd repudiated everything they supposedly believed in. So no, the Tea Party was anti-intellectual. They were anti-ideas. They weren't interested in consistency. They weren't interested in reason. They weren't interested in rationality. They had the right sense of life. They had the right general belief. But when you don't have ideas, that sense of life can easily morph into something else. And what it morphed into is anger. What it morphed into is frustration. And what it morphed into ultimately is mindless Trump support. What it morphed into is the 30% or whatever of the electorate who will vote for Trump even if Trump stands in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoots somebody in cold blood. That's what the Tea Party morphed into. It morphed into the blind, authoritarian-like support that Donald Trump got and is getting from a certain percentage of the population that have given up on ideas because Trump is the anti-ideas. Trump is the anti-intellectual. Trump is the opposite of the founding fathers. He is the ultimate pragmatist from moment to moment, trying to figure out what works, trying to manipulate people to get what works. And what works changes all the time. There are no principles. There are no ideas. There is no intellectual framework for what he is doing. It's not that he believes in liberty or freedom or anything. It's that, and again, Trump, what's scary to me are the people who will defend Trump at all costs. At all costs. No matter what he does, he's great. No matter what he does, literally, he stood in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shot somebody. These people would all defend him. That's authoritarian. Not that he's an authoritarian, that the people, too many people who voted for him, again, not everybody, a certain percentage, I think it's about 20, 30%, way too much, have an authoritarian mentality. They are looking for a leader. They are looking to be told what to do. They are blind followers. And unfortunately, some of the people who follow me are those kind of blind followers who will follow Trump, who will support Trump, will defend Trump no matter what. You might be afraid of the alternative. Everybody's afraid of alternative. So am I. I'm afraid of Trump too. That's the difference. You guys don't seem to be afraid of Trump. And maybe, Buzz, you are, but you know, maybe some of you are, but most of you are not. Most of you are not. Right? Most of you will just defend everything he does, like this stupid deal with Mexico. And you think this is, whoa, isn't this amazing? Read the fine print. Or the stupid trade war with China. Or his comments today on Google, right? He wants the government to investigate Google because he doesn't like how the search results come out. They look rigged to him. It's none of the president's job. It's not his responsibility to monitor Google. This is exactly what the left does. This is exactly what you'd be afraid of Elizabeth Warren doing. So where are all you Trump supporters criticizing Trump? See, I'd have some respect for you if you criticized Trump when he did something as ludicrous, as insane, as evil as what he did today with Google. He's actually got the Justice Department investigating Google. And he's accused them of rigging search results to feature bad news about him. All right. So it's, yeah, everything's rigged, guys. Everything's rigged against Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the savior. And everything, Google and YouTube and everybody's just rigged against him. And you go on and support and defend him no matter what. So that, you know, that's what scares me about Trump, is that what he has gotten, unfortunately, the passionate support is, again, if I go out there and I speak and I look at who the Trump supporters tend to be, they tend to be older Americans who are frustrated, who are very active in the Tea Party movement. That went nowhere, and they're frustrated and angry and afraid and are willing, I think for the first time in their lives, to just support somebody and support anything he does as long as he's not a leftist. They'll just do anything. And they've adopted an authoritarian mentality, a mindless follow the leader mentality. That's where too many of the Tea Party are today.